You're listening to the Radiator 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. My second interview this week is with John Preston, whose novel The Dig came out several years ago in the UK but has just come to the United States. There's talk of the book becoming a film. You'll hear more about that during the interview. John Preston has been the arts editor and television critic of the Sunday Telegraph. He is the author of three highly acclaimed novels, including Kings of the Roundhouse and a travel book, Touching the Moon. He lives in London. A succinct and witty literary venture that tells the strange story of a priceless treasure discovered in East Anglia on the eve of World War II. His new novel, The Dig, is about the Sutton Hoo excavation. In the long, hot summer of 1939, Britain is preparing for war, but on a riverside farm in Suffolk, there is excitement of another kind. Mrs. Pretty, the widowed owner of the farm, has had her hunch confirmed that the mounds on her land hold buried treasure. As the dig proceeds, it becomes clear that this is no ordinary find. This fictional recreation of the famed Sutton Hoo dig follows 3 months of intense activity when locals fought outsiders, professionals thwarted amateurs, and love and rivalry flourished in equal measure. As the war looms ever closer, engraved gold peeks through the soil, and each character searches for answers in the buried treasure. Their threads of love, loss, and aspiration weave a common awareness of the past as something that can never truly be left behind. When I spoke to John Preston, I began by asking him about his interest in Sutton Hoo. I had read that he had a family connection to the dig, and I asked him about that as well. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
I used to be the television critic of a newspaper called the Sunday Telegraph.
Right.
So every Sunday I would have a column in the paper. And one week I was reviewing a program about Lawrence of Arabia, some documentary about Lawrence of Arabia. And I happened to mention that my aunt had lived with Lawrence of Arabia's then sole surviving brother when she was a very old woman.
Oh.
And I got a letter a few days later from this woman saying, I read your article on Sunday. I think I'm your cousin.
Oh.
And I kind of thought, I mean, it's not, there's a sort of semi-reliable rule of thumb that about 90% of people who write into newspapers are kind of mad. So I sort of thought, she's probably a lunatic. So I wrote this rather kind of brusque letter back saying, well, what on earth makes you think that you're related to me? And she wrote an extremely kind of measured, intelligent letter back saying, well, there's this reason and that reason and that reason. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, my God, I really think this woman is my cousin. and she said, well, maybe we should meet up, but, don't leave it too long because I'm 85. So about a week later, I threw some things in my car, and I drove to meet her. And we got on really well. We had lunch together, and sure enough, she was my cousin. And then, just as I was leaving, she said, oh, of course, I'm sure you already know your aunt found the gold at Sutton Hoo, the first piece of gold at Sutton Hoo. And I thought, I had no idea what she was talking about at all. I knew that my aunt had been an archaeologist, but she and my father had had a big falling out, so I didn't really see her when I was a child. And she said, oh, no, you know, your aunt was actually a very eminent archaeologist, and, you know, the Sutton Hoo was like a sort of British Tutankhamun in a way,
yeah.
And there was a big dig in the summer of 1939, and your aunt found the first piece of gold there, and it turned out to be what subsequently turned out to be this kind of extraordinary find and this intact Anglo-Saxon ship with his burial chamber in the center of it. So I kind of went away and I thought, God, this sounds interesting. So I did a bit of research on it, and then I did some more research on it, and then I went to Sun and Hoo and I kind of looked around there. And then I thought, actually, this would be a really good subject for a novel.
Yeah.
So that's essentially how I got started.
Okay, great. And you have written other books. You've written...
Yeah, I have. I mean, I've written other books. I certainly haven't written anything that's kind of remotely about archaeology before.
Right. Okay. All right. Great. Well, I really enjoyed the book. Now,
Now,
when did you start working on it?
Well, that's a very difficult question, because it actually was published over here in about... It was published over here about 8 years ago now.
Oh, wow.
I probably started work on it about 10 years ago.
So that's interesting, because I noticed that there was no mention in the book of the tourists that came around and took photos that were then they turned up in 2011. Do you know about that? I found it online. Some tourists had taken pictures of the excavation and they showed
up. Oh, in 1939.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I did. Well, in fact. What had happened was I decided when I was going to write a novel about it, I thought, this is a really good story. I'm going to have to change a few things to make it, to just to give it a bit more punch dramatically. But I decided that I really wanted not to change anything that I didn't have to.
Yeah.
And the tourists who turned up to take the pictures in the summer of 1939 actually... turned up after my aunt left the dig. So I kind of thought, oh, well, do I want those in there or not? And then I actually thought, no, it'd be more interesting. But I decided I'm going to have a character who was a photographer. And then I thought, well, you can't have too many photographers in there. So I decided to kind of forget about the tourists.
Right. So that was Rory, and he was the nephew of Mrs. Pretty. Was there such a Rory, or is he fictional?
No, he's the only invented character in it.
Okay, I get it. Okay. So I was curious if you... tried to remain true to a certain sense of each historical character, or if you allowed yourself to create their personalities in a completely fictive way.
No, I tried. Insofar as it was possible.
Yeah.
I tried to stick to what I knew about these people.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, my main concern was bringing them to life as characters.
Yeah.
So. I wasn't sort of transfixed about, as it were, producing documentary portraits of them.
Sure.
I just kind of thought, no, you know, if they did, you know, if I wrote something and it sounded sort of right and plausible, and it kind of fitted into the plot, then I sort of let them get on with it to some degree.
Yeah. I very much enjoyed your characters. You had just wonderful little tiny character traits that told us so much about each of them, like Mrs. Pretty, who owns the property where this excavation is taking place.
Yeah.
I loved that she would assess people by what type of dog they might be, or at least she did that a couple times. And I really liked that. And another one that really struck me was when you have Peggy, who in fact is a relative, I guess, of yours, your aunt, she would be your aunt.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have a moment where she's driving her car and she takes her hands off the wheel just to see what will happen as she travels down the road. That was such a wonderful way to show her personality and her, wanting to be more liberated than she maybe was. I don't know. It was really great.
Oh, that's great. I mean, one of the things that really interests, one of the big challenges for me was that I've always felt that women novelists don't seem to have any great problem writing male narrators.
Right.
Male novelists, on the other hand, tend to find it incredibly difficult to write plausible women. I mean, I know that's a wild generalization, but it's kind of true up to a point. I've read so many novels where you get these kind of terrible sentences where is a man writing as a woman says, will write things like, oh, sort of coyly I adjusted my bra strap or something like this. And I thought, God, I really, don't want to do that if I can possibly avoid it. So it was kind of, it was a challenge. But I sort of felt that I did get to know these women very well.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, it's that sort of strange thing as a novelist when you... when you're writing a character, you just can't sort of get into work. And I remember I've got a friend who does pottery, and I think it's an expression potters have got when they're throwing pots, where you suddenly get to the point where the clay starts to work for you, rather than, as it were, against you. And kind of, you know, if you're lucky, you can get to that point as a novelist.
Yeah, absolutely. One more character that I just wanted to talk about really briefly. I loved that you didn't... So there's this character named Charles Phillips, and he mostly comes across as a sort of unlikable character, but I loved that you complicated him. He has his sympathetic moments, and he was not just this big kind of gruff narcissist, which is sort of how he comes across some of the time. But I liked that he was a little more complicated than that, and he had his lighter moments, so that was kind of nice too.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I was just keen to give people a sort of hinterland, as it were, so there was more to them than kind of ostensibly met the eye.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I have a question about a writing style thing, if I may.
You have
an interesting thing that you do with tense. You did it a bunch of times, and I wanted to ask you about it. You kind of, the story is told in the past tense from various points of view, various narrators, but at certain moments you kind of swoop into the present tense for just a second, and I really liked it, and I wondered if you can talk. I've got an example. Do you want to hear an example?
Yeah, I better, yes.
At 7 o'clock, this is from Edith Pretty. At 7 o'clock, I went upstairs to change for dinner. Ellen was waiting in my room. She is a big-boned girl with unusually pale fingers, the result presumably of poor circulation. In the winter, she suffers from chilblains. When she started working for me 2 years ago, I was concerned, and in fact she has, and then we go back to the past tense. So it's just interesting. Why do you do that?
Because I think it kind of... I mean, the ridiculous thing is I'm barely aware of doing it, but I mean... I hope it's not a contrived thing.
No.
But I like that thing of... It just sort of gives you a different... It kind of brings something that's slightly in the background into the foreground, and then you can kind of push it back into the background a bit. And it just to kind of strangle this analogy, I mean, just sort of gives you a bit of depth of field somehow.
Yeah, I felt like I think that it just kind of pulled me a little closer into that moment with them.
That's what I wanted.
Yeah, good. Well, you did it well, and it shows up a few times. I kept making little notes. Oh, wait, he just did that again. That was cool. All right, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about class consciousness in England during this time period, right before World War II. Their world is changing so rapidly. It was lovely. The presence of class consciousness is subtle in this book, but it's definitely there. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Well, to some extent, although the world that I was born into was very different from that world.
Mm.
I was brought up in a very small village in the countryside, and actually it hadn't changed as much, as much as one might have expected.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my grandmother telling me when I was a child, in all seriously, and admittedly, my grandmother was a terrible snob, but she said, you can dine with your doctor, but not your dentist.
Oh, wow.
God, how weird. This is really peculiar. and so that kind of obsessive classifying people according to their class was something that I had a sort of horrible familiarity with. And it's kind of very apt in the story of The Dig, because in a lot of respects it is a story about class.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, you know, Mrs. Pretty, who's the woman who owns the land that the mounds are on, and then you've got Basil Brown, who's the self-educated archaeologist from a completely different class.
Right.
And I wanted to suggest that actually they kind of had a natural understanding, but class kept them apart. And if it hadn't been for class, they might actually have been very good friends, but as it were, they were sort of addressing one another across a kind of open trench.
Right.
And then you've got Yeah, and I think that the world of archaeology then was very much a socially stratified one, along with a lot of other aspects of British society. And then there's a further complication in the dig, in that Peggy, who is obviously a woman, is very much an interloper, and rather a she's sort of tolerated, but not much more, into this, this bastion of masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the sense that Basil, I don't want to give anything away, but Basil's role within the excavation changes at a certain point in the story, and I had the sense that that had to do with class as well as his education and his background.
Absolutely had to do with it. That's completely true.
Yeah.
Which is, and that actually does mirror what happened in real life.
Is that right?
Essentially what happened was that in the summer of 1939, everybody knew that war was imminent. And it was just a matter of when rather than if war was going to break out. So when this huge boat was found, and they realized that there might be an intact burial chamber at the heart of it, what had been a kind of small local archaeological dig, suddenly everybody wanted a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had these kind of Oxbridge educated archaeologists moving in, creating a lot of bad feeling.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. John, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the details. You bring us into moments so beautifully. And do you mind if I just read a paragraph?
No, not at all.
Okay. So this is from Peggy's point of view. Peggy is the woman who was your aunt who helped on the dig. And she and her husband are driving in the car, and they pull over to have lunch. On the other side of the town, we pulled into a field to eat the sandwiches Stuart's sister had made. Several other cars were already parked there. People sat on the verge, eating and drinking. The men were in their shirt sleeves. A couple of the women I saw had rolled their stockings down to their ankles. Children were playing, throwing stones at a cattle trough. Whenever one of the stones hit, there was a loud booming sound. Every so often, one of the adults turned around and told them to stop, but they didn't take any notice. I just loved this scene. There were a number of scenes like this, and part of what I loved was your recounting of it so well, but also it's a lost time. We don't stop for lunch in fields anymore. We don't over here anyway.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I kind of wanted to contrast the fact that Peggy and her husband Stuart, although they've only just got married,
right?
They're kind of both of them emotionally incredibly constipated,
yeah.
And and she's watching these people who are just kind of at ease with themselves, or at least to a much greater degree than she is, or indeed really will ever be.
Right. That's true. I didn't think about that at the time, that from her perspective, this is, of course, a very special moment. It's something she sort of yearns toward but can't find.
Yeah.
And there was another moment in the book, this is just teeny tiny, but there's a moment where you have somebody who's wearing a cap. He bends down, and you mention that the cap looks like a big inane smile, the edge of the cap. You know, I think sometimes when writers can deliver these details in a way that we've never thought of before, it brings it home to us in a very familiar way, but in a new way, which is one of the best things about reading, when somebody actually gives you something new to hold on to see something familiar. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I guess that's what one aims for, really, because it's very easy to get a kind of arresting image,
right?
But actually it's terribly contrived, and I tried with this, one of my main concerns was that every time there was a kind of an image, I wanted it to have a kind of sort of crystalline quality, but not, I hoped, not to be in any way contrived.
No, I didn't think that. Okay, I wanted to ask you about the medium in the book. There's actually a couple of scenes that have to do with people trying to find their past loved ones by visiting a medium or going to see one speak. And I thought this was in between wars. This must have been a time of great preoccupation with an afterlife and spirits and connecting with loved ones. Is this based on anything?
Yes. I mean, there was a huge rise in interest in spiritualism after the First World War, because so many people had lost relatives and loved ones. And there was a terrible sort of hankering to try and get in touch with them again. It was an era in which mediums really flourished. Mm-hmm. And a lot of spiritualist churches sprung up, some of which are still going. Indeed, one of them I went to for this, to research this.
Okay.
It also seemed very apt where, archaeology is about, on one level, trying to get in touch with the dead.
Right.
And trying to kind of disinter people.
That's great. When you went to the one that you were researching, when you were doing your research and you went to hear a medium speak, did you find it? I thought the scene was very sympathetic to the people who were sitting there hoping to connect with their loved ones. Was that your experience, or was it a little hokier than that when you went?
It was a kind of a cross between the two in a weird way. I don't think it's still there, but actually, until quite a few years ago, there's a square in London called Belgrave Square, which is very smart, and there are kind of embassies there and stuff, and it's just very near Knightsbridge, and there always used to be one very shabby house there, and I'd walk past it occasionally, and I was really fascinated by it, and it turned out to be the headquarters of I can't remember if it's called the Spiritualist Association or something like this, and Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories,
sure,
actually gave the lease of this house to the Spiritualist Association, because he got very interested in spiritualism. And they used to have this really weird thing there, which is sort of first Wednesday in the month, they would have an audition evening for trainee mediums. And I went along to a couple of these things. And it was sort of farcical and pitiful at the same time, because actually, These training mediums were terrible. I mean, they were just, they hadn't got a clue. And I mean, it was like, a woman or man would go, oh, I'm getting a Dennis or something. Anybody here know anyone called Dennis? And then it'd be kind of deathly silence. Oh, no, I didn't mean Dennis. I meant Rachel or something like this. It was just kind of mad. It was just like absolutely barking mad. But I did find it terribly poignant, of course, because, it is. I mean, how can it not be, really?
Right. I love all the stories of Houdini having tried to make that connection. I think it was probably a very, very popular thing for a certain period of time. Now it's always sort of, it's just kind of like a funny thing to do.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the excavation itself. Did you do a lot of research on how these digs are conducted? I was interested also in how concerned they were about whether or not the mounds would have been vulnerable to robbers.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of research, because, I knew absolutely nothing about archaeology when I started this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never been in an archaeological dig. Frankly, I'd never had the slightest desire to go on an archaeology. I was kind of interested, but I just knew I'd find it terribly boring. I mean, I think you've got to have a really sort of, obsessive quality to be into it. I really very much admire people who are into it, but I just sort of instinctively felt that it wasn't for me. But at the same time, I felt that archaeology is, in a funny sort of way, not that dissimilar to writing a novel, in that, you see these people and they've got these kind of fine brushes and they're scraping away and they find something and they sweep some earth off it, and then, gradually this thing kind of comes into shape. And, when you're writing, that's kind of what you do with characters, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a kind of, for me, there was a sort of worthwhile analogy there.
Yeah.
But I did have to do a lot of research into it.
Yeah.
And I, fortunately, there was a man who had been the chief archaeologist at Sutton who was incredibly helpful and very patiently explained to me how these things worked. And then I kind of, you know, I just sort of, again, tried to stick to the details of what had happened. And I was quite lucky in that there was some my aunt had actually left some diaries. Not really about Sutton Hoo, but there was some stuff there. And then Basil Brown had left some diaries. And the whole, you know, because it became so famous, Sutton Hoo, there was a lot of documentation about it. And a lot of, to my mind, a lot of it paralyzingly dull. But I mean, you know, I kind of plowed my way through all this stuff and then just sort of synthesized it down.
Yeah. There was a great moment. I don't know if this was intentional, but you had this great line. Basil Brown has just learned about Mrs. Pretty's husband and what happened with their marriage and how he died on his birthday by coincidence. Mm-hmm. But then he's also just learned that he had asked Mrs. Pretty to marry him over and over and over, year after year, and she always said no as long as her own father was alive because she was taking care of him. And you have this moment where Basil says, I wondered how he'd stood it year after year being turned down, all that time hoping one day his luck might change. And to me, that just sounded a lot like what archaeologists must feel every day.
You know? Yeah, and that story is completely true as well.
Is it?
About Mrs. Pretty. Yeah. I mean, that is, you know, essentially what happened. Yeah, I think, was it 17 years? I can't remember how many years.
Yeah,
and this man
like
just
that.
Kept asking her year after year after year to marry her. And every year, always on her birthday. And then she kept saying no because she was looking after her father who was ill. And then her father died. And the next year he asked and they got married.
Yeah.
And then very sadly he died not that long afterwards.
And did she have a child at 47?
She did indeed have a child at 47, yeah.
Wow.
And that was the kind of, you know, in one sense, a fantastic blessing for her.
Sure.
But she got very ill when she was pregnant, and indeed that sort of destroyed her health.
Oh.
And she, the real life Mrs. Pretty, did indeed die pretty soon, I mean, only a few years after the Sutton Hoo excavation in the early 40s, as far
as
I remember.
Right, and her son
and
had
she
to
wasn't
go
old.
Live with relatives. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, is Robert still alive, her son?
No, he died.
Oh, okay.
He died early.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to be in touch with any relatives from the British family. I'm not even sure, you know, presumably there are some. But I very much doubt that anyone alive who still remembers Mrs. Pretty.
Mm-hmm. I want to change gears a little bit for a second. I know that you have been a TV critic, and I'm curious about writing television reviews. You know, literary reviewers used to take on work even if they were going to write a really negative review, but I think there's less of that now. I think a lot of literary reviewers will only take on a book if they can write a fairly positive review. And I'm curious if that's true for television, and
I think it is. I don't really, I mean, I stopped being a television critic about 10 years ago.
Okay.
Partly because I thought I couldn't stand to watch another television program. But I'd done it for about 10 years, and it had changed a hell of a lot in that time. And the thing about British television was that, you know, there used to be very few channels.
Right, well, same here.
Even in the kind of 1990s, you could be pretty confident that you would write about something, and there was a reasonable chance that someone would have seen it. Now, of course, you know, the whole thing is massively fragmented, and it's changed a lot. I mean, you know, it's like anything, really. I mean, you know, if you're criticizing it, you are inevitably going to be picking holes in it to some degree.
Right.
It's a question of how constructive you can be at the same time as picking holes in it, I suppose.
Right. Do you have any television that you would recommend right now, or are you truly not watching TV anymore?
Well, weirdly, actually, I think, I don't know if it's come out in the States. There's a series called The Night Manager come on.
Oh, that sounds familiar. I haven't watched it.
It's adapted from a John le Carré novel, but the reason I say it is actually it's directed by a woman called Suzanne Beer, who is supposed to be directing the film version of The Dig, which I hope is, I mean, I'll kind of believe this when it happens, but it's, I think, supposed to be happening this summer.
Oh, great.
But, you know, the trouble is these things are so unreliable.
As I read it, I thought it would make a good film. I thought it was one of those books that could turn nicely into
a film. It's got a very good script, not written by me, incidentally. But I think it is a very good script.
All right, great. I wanted to ask what you're working on these days.
Well, I've got a book that really comes out in the UK tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
And it's coming out in the States, I think, in October, which is a non-fiction book about a politician. There was a big scandal here in the 1970s where there was a man called Jeremy Thorpe, who'd been the leader of the Liberal Party, which was the kind of most socially progressive mm-hmm. party in the country. And in the early 1970s, he sort of stood poised to hold the balance of power in a coalition government. So he was a very powerful man. And then 5 years after that, he went on trial at the Old Bailey, accused of incitement to murder and conspiracy to murder his former boyfriend.
Oh.
So, and it was like, yeah, it was kind of the first time that a really prominent politician in this country was exposed, and he really was exposed as being gay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a time when there was still enormous prejudice against homosexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
that would be huge.
It's all about that, really. Sorry?
I said that would be huge to not only be exposed about your sexual preference, but also accused of murder in the same.
Yeah, no, it was a really, really big, kind of incredibly bizarre and complex case. So I've written about that. That's kind of kept me reasonably busy for a bit.
Yeah, what's the book called?
It's called A Very English Scandal.
Okay. All right, great. I just have one last question for you, really.
Sure.
I like to ask for advice at the end. And so I thought for you, I would ask for advice about conveying historical subject matter without this, like, fraught import. It seems like so many historical novels just have this tone of great seriousness. And this book was serious, but it was also light in moments. And the Times Literary Supplement called it wistful and poignant. I thought that was accurate. So can you talk a little bit about the tone?
Well, I think that when you're writing about anything that's set in the past, to some degree, it is like peering down the wrong end of a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of, you know, your distance from the things that you're writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wanted to have that sense of distance, but at the same time, I wanted it to have an immediacy. And, you know, there's a sort of terrible fallacy that people behaved and reacted to things in ways that were fundamentally different, you know, 50 years ago, mm-hmm. 100 years ago, whatever. And, of course, they may have done as a result of particular social conventions or whatever, or circumstances. But, you know, the way that people are kind of wired emotionally doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's what I wanted to do was to bring it alive as much as possible.
Right.
And for me, if you as a reader feel that you're kind of metaphorically extending an arm and touching someone who, you know, died 50, 100 years ago, whatever, I mean, that's a really sort of satisfying, almost sort of mystical thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it really fascinates me to see if one can do it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great way to put it. You know, and I think the scenes with Robert really brought that to light for me, because, you know, there's a little boy running around this excavation, and that would be difficult in any decade, in any time.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, you know, what I wanted about, you know, I think, you know, if I absolutely had to boil down what fascinated me about the gig, why I wanted to do it, was that it was like, you know, when I was a child, when I was that boy's age, I loved, above all, stories about buried treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story about buried treasure for grown-ups,
yeah,
basically.
Right. But he must have been so thrilled, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and in fact, the story that's in the book where they start taking the gold out of the ground, and they don't know where to put it. And, you know, they obviously want it to be somewhat secure, and they end up putting it under the boy's bed. And he's sleeping on top of all this gold. And obviously there's a mattress between him and the gold. But I just thought, my God, you know, what an amazing feeling for a child.
Yeah.
You know, right. You're literally going to bed, and there's this kind of stash of Anglo-Saxon gold inches away from where you're lying.
Right, right. And I loved that they wrapped some of the stuff to take it to the museum. They wrapped it in his candy wrappers or something.
Yeah.
Great. Wonderful. Well, John Preston, I want to just mention again, the book is The Dig, published by The Other Press in April. And I really appreciate your talking with me today.
That's great. Thank you very much indeed.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with John Preston, whose publisher's website is otherpress.com. There were two interviews today, Denisha Smith and John Preston, and both of them are published by The Other Press. Today is May 9th. On this day in 1429, Joan of Arc defeated the besieging English at Orleans. On this day in 1502, Christopher Columbus left Spain for his final trip to the Western Hemisphere. And on May 9th, 1994, Nelson Mandela was chosen to be South Africa's first black president. So this week, the Write the Book prompt is to write about one of those historical events while trying to do what John Preston mentioned at the end of our interview, which is to try to make it real, give it an immediacy despite being distanced by history. He says, the way that people are wired emotionally doesn't change. Bring your characters to life, breathe as much life into them as you can to allow the reader to metaphorically extend an arm and touch a character who has been gone for, in some cases, a very long time. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information, or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at Big Heavy World every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast by going to my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. You can also visit the website of my co-host, Gary Miller, GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Write the Book was chosen by Writer's Digest in the present issue that's out now as one of 101 best websites for writers. So that magazine is out right now, and we appreciate your support. We hope that you enjoy the podcast. So please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro. You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.